So we're here Saturday at the Armidale Show. Brilliant day, perfect weather. The ground looks magnificent, looking out over the horses from where we're sitting. And I'm delighted to have as our guest Sam Copeland, the Mayor of Armidale Regional Council, who's just come over. And so I've grabbed him and for an interview and just said, I just want to talk about good news stories for Armidale and our council area, Sam. Over to you.
Oh, thanks, Rob. And it's always a treat to, you know, have an interview, always a treat to catch up with you and Mike. And it is a wonderful setting here. But, yeah, good news stories. I think you could start with the show, for one. I mean, magnificent day. And we really do need to take a breath. And I think, you know, always look on the positive side of things. We have great facilities here at the show. But if we're looking a bit more big picture, there's no doubt there is activity happening around town. You're seeing a lot more high vis, and I think you're seeing a lot more construction happening. And as we sit here, we're looking across at Cook's Hill, and I think that's going to be a development of 240 new housing lots. Now, a number of those have already been, you know, built on over the last few years, but more to come there. And if I was to scratch my head, I'd say that we have around 400 lots, you know, yet to be released and yet to be built. And one of our challenges at the moment, you know, as you'd know, Rob, from your time, there's always a challenge, and nothing, you know, growth doesn't happen in that planned linear fashion. It's not, at the moment we have severe housing undersupply, and that's likely to continue for a while. But at council, we're on top of that, and we've started to do a bit of strategic plan about our logical extension areas, and we'll be coming out with the final report in the next couple of months that we'll, you know, be able to share more broadly with the community. But, you know, we've identified just where the logical extension of our water and sewerage can go, and there's about another 10,000-ish lots that could be released in the wider you know, Armidale region. So not just Armidale itself. So, you know, an extension up around Gyro, some more housing there, and then some of the smaller villages as well. So, which is what we need.
Absolutely. Well, I live the top of Chestnut Avenue, and I'm in the family home, actually, and growing up there, we were effectively in the country, and now, of course, the development is beyond us, Netherton Park and the Heights and those areas, and it just keeps going. There's development everywhere, and I think it's great. As I told you, Sam, I talked to Todd Redwood this morning, and we talked mainly about water. And because of what your council is doing with water development, which is fantastic, the last council seemed to refuse to do, this will really help open up opportunities in Armidale and grow a population, which is what we really need to have happen.
Yeah, look, you're spot on there, Rob. The water, your availability of water is actually the cap on population, and if you don't have that, so we've removed that very significant and very real obstacle to growth. So with that out of the way, we need to pin the ears back and just on housing. It's something I was actually interviewed by Sky News yesterday morning. And this is part of the Country Mayors Association, our election priorities, and one of the big ones is housing. And so I was speaking about that and what we'd like, the assistance that we need from state government to make it easier to develop here. So there are currently some limitations around what the state government will let us do. So we're trying to get those lifted. But even if we think about assistance that the state government can provide, and that'd be things such as interest-free loans to extend those services like, you know, water and sewerage, get those things already in place, and then, you know, at an interest-free basis. So then when the development catches up, there's no delays there, and away we go. So that'd be the sort of thing that we could do. There would be the option, I guess, for council to develop some lots, not necessarily build the houses, but, you know, put all the infrastructure in, the roads and everything, and sell the lots off. And Forbes has done that recently, Forbes Council, and what they did, which was very clever, and I think we'd need to do that here in Armidale, is keep some of those houses aside for essential services. So when we talk about a housing shortage, it falls into a number of different categories. So there's a shortage for the general population. There's a shortage of housing for essential workers, so doctors, nurses, etc. In particular, and as you know, we have that GP crisis here, which is very real. And hopefully there is a solution on the horizon there with the single employer model that was announced but not yet signed off. And that, you know, if that happens, that'll speed things up. But I was speaking with some of the GPs on Thursday, along with Todd, and they've said, look, getting housing for our, you know, essential workers moving here is an issue, as is childcare. So we've just got to really push those things as well. So there's a shortage of housing all up. There's a shortage of housing for essential services. So I think we would need any development we did just to quarantine some housing for those workers.
Absolutely. And I'm glad you're talking about we've been talking about housing right through the interview so far, directly and indirectly. But just before you came over, Mike and I were actually talking about the hot housing in Gaia for the overseas workers, for
yes,
the seasonal worker program, and that's starting to expand. That they're developing more and taking over more accommodation up there, and the different demographic of people walking down the streets in Gaia, which is fantastic. It's got to be good for Gaia.
Look, you'd think so. I think the accommodation solutions, if you want to call it, for the tomato farm workers are pretty substandard. It hasn't been well thought through, and if anything, we could take that, if you wanted to put your optimistic hat on, we'd take that as a salient lesson of what needs to happen when the renewable energy zone comes, because that is going to be a massive change when the construction of that starts. What are we in 2023 now? I think we'll start to see construction in 25. We already have some workers housed, I think, in the old Drummond College, and that were working on METs. Now that's pretty much operational now. But every wind farm that crops up requires roughly 400 workers for 2 years. And Armidale will be the hub of it. So, you know, to our south, Euralla and Walker, they just don't have the capacity to host those people. Now, even, truth be told, in Armidale, we don't at the moment either. So one of the things that we, and when I say we, I mean council, are going to have to really work with the individual renewable proponents, but also the Department of Planning, to ensure that there is a proper housing solution. So if I were to put my, if I were to think about what would be the best outcome, it would be something akin to an Olympic Village, where you can intensively house people. And then, you know, Sydney did this. They intensively housed people, and they reconverted those dwellings into townhouses and sold them off. So if part of the legacy of hosting the renewable energy zone was some cost-effective yet high-quality housing, that would just be a terrific outcome all round. And from the conversations that I've had with other mayors in our renewable energy zone, but also the Central West, where there's a group of us have got together, that's at the top of our mind, and we have been having conversations with the right people to make sure that comes through. So yeah, the tomato farm, that probably was an opportunity lost, but we've got to make sure that doesn't happen again.
Yeah, and I'm glad you mentioned the renewable energy zone, and I was talking to a prominent grazier yesterday, actually, and he was just saying that the property next door to him, it's out on the Burralong Road, have signed a deal with the wind towers, and he said it's just look, I can see the positives, absolutely, but he said it's pitting neighbour against neighbour, yeah. And I know that's happening in the Walker area as well, and I know you've got very involved in this in a positive way, so is there a solution there? I mean, it's a big
look,
problem.
There isn't really. There's no wave a magic wand and it all goes away. But it could be done a lot better. And so I was in a meeting the beginning of last week with the Department of Planning, so some honchos from there, Energy Co. that is running the Renewable Energy Zone, and Matt Keane, the Energy Minister and Treasurer, he came along as well. So this particular meeting, it was the Coalition of Renewable Energy Mayors. I'm sort of leading, I'll get to answer your question in a sec. Coalition of Renewable Energy Mayors, and we, of which I'm the chair, and I've sort of formed it. We asked those groups to come along because we have some serious concerns, and it was really highlighted by what's happening in Walcha, what's happening out along Burralong Road, and what makes it particularly tough here in the, you know, New England RES or Renewable Energy Zone is that the energy proponents, wherever they've set up before, they've been the only show in town. So there's just been one little fight to have and it all gets papered over and away we go. This is radically different. They're going to be one of 50 shows within this region. And our region cannot afford to have the way they've historically gone about business, where they put in an ambit claim about how big their project is or what their planned project is. And it is an ambit claim. They know it's not going to get through. And then they pare it back. And they say, oh, then the whole community consultation. Now, that community consultation comes about after neighbours go at each other, and which you can understand why that happens, or why the angst is there, and then they'll sort of reshape their project back to something that's palatable. And to me, that doesn't need to happen, and this is a message we put to the Department of Planning, and that is your wind and solar guidelines, which is what all of the proponents are meant to abide by, they actually need to be enforceable. So if the rules were written properly and the rules were enforced, then we wouldn't have this this particular outcome. Mm. So unfortunately, I don't think there is a solution to the neighbour against, you know, it comes down to money, really. Mm. Mm. It can be done much better. There can be much more transparent discussion. The energy companies should only propose projects that have any chance of success and then have community consultation, not put the ambit claim in, and if they do, they should be knocked out. Mm. And if the energy companies don't do this, then I think it's up to the hosts, who are getting paid significant money to host projects, to actually be the grown-up in the room. Mm. To say to the energy company, look, don't put that out there. That's actually going to rub my near neighbour that, you know, for generations we've lived and worked alongside. It's going to rub them up the wrong way. Mm. Now, that would work if everyone has the same sense of right and wrong and morality, but, you know, not everyone does. So I think it can be improved if people just behave decently. Yep. And rules should be there for when you don't behave decently, and that's why we need the Department of Planning to tighten up those wind and solar guidelines. But what you're seeing out in the where the developments are set up, those farmers aren't the biggest, those that are going to be most impacted. It's actually those that living in the town are. Where are we going to host 2,000 workers? Mm. It's not all about looking at a wind tower. This is a community-wide problem. Mm. It's not a localised problem. And that's something that, and it's just magnified here in our res because of the number of projects that are up and running. So it's a... You know, at the moment I'm supportive of the RES, but my role really is, and the role of council is, to shape it as best we can. Now, hitherto, council's largely been left out of the conversation because it's a state significant development. And by coming together with the other councils, the other four councils in New England and the five councils in the Central West, plus the near neighbour, so Tamworth's Keen as well, we've actually got a fairly solid block, and I never thought I'd be a union organiser, but here I am.
Well, I'm really glad you've done that, because I know when this was first all happening, councils seemed to feel a bit powerless, and you've proved that that's not the case, and it's strength in numbers that brought these mayors together, and it's fantastic. And Sam, we might finish, but on a positive note, because that's what this interview is all about.
That's right.
Keep it positive.
Keep it positive.
And that's the asking about the airport, and of course I'm very wedded, I suppose, to the airport development, because it started on a council I was on in 2009, and I think it's fantastic, and I think it's going to be really important for the future of our area. But to, on a specific note, and I know that you won't have an answer for this, but you might have thoughts on it, is the possibility of eventually having a second runway.
Yeah, I guess there's a couple of things. So there is the airport that you mentioned that you're well across, and many people are. 75% of those lots have been sold. So we just haven't seen the construction start yet. We were hoping a bit would have happened last year, but the limitations on materials. But we'll start to see things pop up out of the ground. A number of the designs I've seen already are really impressive. You know, you don't drive past industrial sites and think, wow, that looks schmick, but this will be one that you do. So I'm really pleased that, you know, councils passed, or ARC over the last little while, has actually held its ground and I think come up with something that is going to be very impressive. And then when the next stage is developed, which is adjoins the runway and so gives access to the apron, they'll be very sought after lots. But to your question of a second runway, look, that would be ideal. It's going to cost a lot of money. $140 million is the costed up things I've seen. These things always ratchet up. Reality is we'd need state and federal money into that. If I was in my bones, I feel that the current federal government feels that New England has probably had a pretty good run. So it would take some pretty tight lobbying to get to eke money out of them. But as we see, it's certainly going to be needed if our intensive horticulture increases, because that's going to make a difference, particularly for things like berries that might need to go out really quickly and be anywhere. So as our production via intensive horticulture increases, the demand for a runway that can carry heavy jets will be important. So we're certainly not going to put that in the too hard basket. It's something that we'll keep chipping away at. And one thing I've learned in my mere 14 months in this role is that chipping away really is the thing to do.
Absolutely. And look, I think, you know, generally this council's doing a great job. We had the issues with the last council and them being suspended, and it was a fairly dark period in Armidale's history, but look, it seems so far behind us now, and there's a lot of positive stuff happening, and I think the team of councillors, the executive team, are doing a great job, so keep it up, and I'm really pleased you called in for an interview.
Thanks,
Sam.
Thanks, Rob. Great to catch up with you.
Thanks, Sam.
Right.